I grinned stupidly to myself as the air hissed out and the tyre rims settled on the frozen mud. Watching the hole in the wall for torchlight, I was 8 years old again, crouching by my stepfather's car. Moving back to the kit, I pushed the det cord through the hole in the wall once more, then cut several 8-inch strips of gaffer tape from the roll and stuck them around both forearms. Finally, I shouldered the pack of charges, gripped the coiled-up main line in my left hand, and moved back out into the cold. Chapter 41. I headed for the gap between the two buildings. Ahead of me, the dim light from the house still spilled onto the snow. I cleared the gap and moved towards the rear. Stepping over the jenny cable, I checked the det cord was still in the hole, ready for when I came back for it later, then continued down to the corner. The elevations of the dishes had changed dramatically. I wanted to make one last check for Tom through the gap in the boards. Maybe I'd be in luck. There's a first time for everything. Angling my head, I peered through, but couldn't see any movement. Stepping over the satellite dish cables, I made my way to the far corner, then turned and counted 3 paces towards the front of the target. I crouched down at that point and placed the charges and reel of det cord onto the snow. The computer room was on the other side of this wall. It was going to be gloves on, gloves off for the next 20 minutes as I positioned the charges. Undoing the tow rope that kept the charges together, I placed one of the foam squares against the bricks, the base of the Toblerones facing the target, so the det tail dangled in front of me. Then, ramming the end of one of the wooden pallet slats into the snow at an angle, I used it to keep the polystyrene square in position against the wall. When I checked the charge, with the aid of the torch, I discovered a tiny break where a PE joint had come apart. This didn't mean to say the PE wouldn't initiate, since the gap was less than 1/16 of an inch. But why take that chance? Manipulating a small lump of PE between my gloved hands until it was pliable, I broke off a piece and plugged the space. After a final check, I killed the torch and moved over to the nearest dish. I lifted one of its ice-hard sandbags and placed it halfway along the wall, using it to weigh down the free end of the main line. I then began the process of laying out its 43 arms' lengths back towards the charge. The weight of the sandbag enabled me to pull the cord gently to ensure there weren't any kinks or twists, so the shockwave had a free run to the det tails. Once I reached the propped-up charge, it was gloves-off time again. Peeling one of the strips of tape from my forearm, I began to bind the det tail to the main line, taping the two sections together as tightly as possible. I did it strictly by the book, binding the main line 1 foot down the det tail in case some of the explosive had fallen from the exposed end. The binding was 4 inches, to guarantee enough contact between the two for the shockwave to transfer across from the main line to the det tail. Then, of course, it would journey on down to the charge. As I peeled off another strip of tape, it dawned on me that whenever I was working on dems, I always used feet and inches rather than meters and kilos. That was the way I'd been taught. One of the main reasons being that it made life a lot easier when working with Americans, who weren't too keen on the metric system. There was a sudden burst of loud music from an upstairs window around the back, stopping as abruptly as it had started. I instinctively ducked, and through the rear windows I could hear various voices shouting. At least another 3 different voices could be heard shouting back and laughing. It brought me back to real life. The act of tactically placing charges always seems to detach you from reality. Maybe it's because there's so much concentration involved, because there are no second chances. That's why you normally make sure that whoever is doing the technical stuff can just get on with it and concentrate. It wasn't a luxury I had tonight. I nicked another sandbag from the base of the dish and placed it on top of the main line, on the dish side of the det tail. I didn't want to pull on it and disrupt the charge I'd already set up as I picked up the second charge. I began to unreel the main line over the satellite cable towards the gap between the two buildings. Someone was fucking with the volume, as Aerosmith's theme song from Armageddon got louder and then suddenly died above me, prompting more shouts from the computer room. Just as I reached the next corner, the heavy Eastern European voices above bellowed out yet again, and the music bled out at full volume. I knelt between the two buildings, and rigged up the second charge on the other side of the target house, so that it was exactly facing the first. Once it was propped and checked, I began taping its deck tail to the main line. The music hit full blast again for 2 seconds, then subsided. There were more shouts from downstairs. The boys in the computer room were getting ever so slightly pissed off. I reckoned there was a minimum of 5 people in the building. I gave the charge a final check. It was looking good. Demolitions can appear to be a dark art, but actually all you need to understand is how explosives work, and then learn the hundreds of rules for using them. I'd broken many of them today. But what the hell? I hadn't had a lot of choice. I went over to the generator cable hole and gently pulled out the det cord that ran into the fuel tank, taping it to the main line in the same way as I'd done with the other two. Aerosmith was still doing their best to annoy the computer room. It was a good game, and I hoped it would keep the boys occupied for a moment or two longer. I thought about Tom, and hoped he wasn't standing too close to either of the walls. Gloves back on. I pulled the main line for the last few arm's lengths towards the front of the building. Now, I just had to attach the electric detonator, which was already fixed to the firing cable, then unreel the cable round the corner and get down below the MTB window before the shit and everything else in the building hit the fan. I was a bit worried about the amount of extraneous electricity flying about and its possible effect on the firing cable. Once I'd untwisted the 2 leads that were to go on the battery, they'd be potential antennae, just like the dets in the Narva flat. The manuals would say I was either supposed to be 1 kilometre away when the shit went up, or very well protected. I didn't think hiding round the corner with a few clay bricks as cover was quite what they had in mind. The main line stopped, about 6 or 7 paces short of the corner of the target. Great. At least the firing cable would be long enough for me to be well under the window. As I gently pulled at the press studs holding the zip flap of my jacket to extract the firing cable, the volume of the music changed again. It was escaping outside. Then I heard the noise of the grill swinging open and the front door slamming shut. There was no time to think. Just do. Biting off my gloves, I jammed my hand into my jacket pocket for the Makarov, right thumb taking off the safety as I moved towards the corner, taking deep breaths. I couldn't hear him, them, yet, but whichever it was, I had to take the fight to them. 3 more paces until the corner. There was torchlight ahead. I stopped, pushing my thumb down on the safety catch to ensure it was off. 1 more second and a body appeared, heading towards me. He was looking down at where his torch beam hit the snow. It glinted off his weapon barrel. I couldn't give him time to think. I jumped onto him, wrapping my left arm around his neck and pushing the Makarov into his stomach, digging it into him hard. My legs wrapped around his waist, and as we fell together, I pulled the trigger, hoping that our 2 bodies sandwiching the weapon would suppress its report. No chance. The job had just gone noisy. Jumping to my feet, I sprinted round to the front of the house, focusing solely on the next corner, heading for the other end of the main line, leaving a screaming Russian writhing in the snow. I racked back the weapon's top slide to eject whatever was in there and feed in another round, just in case we'd been so close that it had been prevented from sliding back correctly when I'd fired and hadn't reloaded. I had the same feeling in my stomach as I used to have as a kid, running scared. As I neared the main entrance, I scrambled frantically with my left hand for the firing cable and det in my inside pocket. The door opened, MTV still blasting, and a body too small to be Tom emerged. The grill was already open.
Gori! Gori!
I raised my weapon and fired on the move. I couldn't miss. There was a scream and 1 round hit the grill with a high-pitched metallic ricochet. I carried straight on past, turned the corner and made a headlong dive towards the sandbag, dropping my weapon and desperately fishing for the main line coming from under the sandbag. I didn't look up to see if anyone was coming for me. I didn't have time. The wounded man's screams echoed around the compound. I tried to calm myself and slow my frenzied movements. I held the dets onto the main line and wrapped a strip of tape around both. Not as tightly as I would have liked, but fuck it. I pulled out the battery and yanked the twisted end leads of the firing cable apart with my teeth. Then, falling to the floor, I squeezed my legs together, opened my jaw, and buried my head in the snow as I pushed the two leads onto the terminals. Less than a single heartbeat later, the detonator exploded and initiated the main line. The shockwave of the explosion travelled along it, met the first det tail, and then the one leading to the fuel tank. Then the second det tail got the good news. The two wall charges exploded virtually simultaneously, and the resultant shockwaves met in the middle of the room at a combined speed of 52,000 feet per second. Chapter 42. My whole world shuddered, trembled, quaked. It was like being inside a massive bell that had just been given an almighty bang. The air was sucked from my lungs as hot air blasted over me. Around the compound, snow and ice shot upwards a foot or so from the ground. My ears rang. Brick dust, snow and shattered glass cascaded around me. Then the shockwave rebounded off the thick concrete perimeter walls and came back for more. Crawling forward to the corner of the target, I watched, mesmerized, as an enormous fireball whooshed from the entrance of the generator building and leaped high into the sky. Thick black smoke, mixed with bright orange flames that burned like an oil rig flare. The entire area was bathed in light, and I could feel the heat scorching my face. Chunks of brick, glass, and all kinds of other stuff that had been blown sky high started clattering around me. Scrambling to my knees, I threw my arms over my head to protect myself. You're supposed to look up, to prepare for the stuff coming towards you, but fuck that. I just kept close to the wall and took my chances. I wouldn't be able to see it anyway. The sandstorm of red brick dust had arrived, blanketing the compound. It was just a matter of hanging in there and waiting for the last of the fallout to rain down. I began coughing like a lifelong smoker. I cleared each nostril in turn, then tried to equalize the pressure in my ears. A sharp, stinging pain seared across my buttocks. My arse must have taken some of the shockwave as it passed over me. At least it wasn't my face or bollocks. I checked for blood, but my fingers came back just wet with water from the snow-soaked jeans. It was time to get to my feet and start moving back for my weapon, which was still in the snow somewhere. I felt around on my hands and knees, my arse in agony, as if I'd just been caned. I found the Makarov by the sandbag, and, checking chamber with my finger to the heavy, rumbling sound of burning fuel, I stumbled towards the main door. There was a secondary explosion in the generator building, probably a vehicle fuel tank in the path of the firestorm. For the next few moments, the flames burned higher and more intensely. The guy in the gap wasn't screaming anymore, but he was still alive, coiled up and holding his stomach. I went over to where he lay, trembling in the snow. I picked up his AK and threw it towards the main gate, out of his reach. I certainly wouldn't be needing it myself inside the house. When the two shockwaves from the opposing explosions had met, they would have wiped out everything in the computer room. The force would then have taken the line of least resistance to escape the confines of the building, the windows and doors. Surging along the hallways, it would have destroyed everything in its path. The MTV man wasn't looking good. Some bits of him were draped on the grill like strips of meat hanging in a smokehouse. The rest would have been scattered out in the snow. When humans burn, they smell like scorched pork. But when they're blown apart like this, it's as if you've walked into a butcher shop a week after a power cut. The torchlight wasn't much good in the hallway. It just reflected off the wall of dust like a car's headlights in dense fog. I blundered around, stumbling over bricks and other debris, trying to find the gap to the right that would lead to the MTV room. I found the door, or rather, the place where it had been. As I moved through, my feet collided with sticks of furniture. Then what was left of the television set and a whole lot more bricks. I was still coughing shit out of my lungs, and was the only one doing so. I could hear no other movement, no sounds of distress. Tripping over a large bundle on the floor, I switched on my torch and knelt down to check it. The body was on its side and smouldering, facing away from me. Rolling him towards me, I shone the light into his dust-covered face. It wasn't Tom. Whoever this man in his early 20s had been, he wasn't any more. The skin was pulled back from his head like a partly peeled orange, and the blood he'd lost was mixing with the dust to look like wet, red cement. I continued across the room, kicking out and feeling like a blind man as I searched for more bodies. There were two, but neither of them was Tom. I wasn't going to call out, in case someone decided to reply with something other than a voice. I tried to get into the room opposite, the kitchen, but the door was jammed. Leaving it to go upstairs, I decided to check the easy places first. I didn't bother with the computer room. Even if there were any bodies there, they wouldn't be recognizable. In other circumstances, I might have taken a moment or two to be quietly proud. I was shit at most things, but in A-level demolitions, I'd got a distinction. I headed up the stairs, my left hand on the wall, having to feel for every step as I made my way to the top. I cleared my nostrils again, gobbing the dust out of my throat as I equalized my nose again to clear the ringing in my ears. As I reached the top of the landing, I heard a short, faint cry. I couldn't tell where it came from. I went left first, since it was nearer. Feeling my way to the door, I pushed, but it wouldn't budge more than 4 or 5 inches. Pushing even harder, I managed to get my foot round and made contact with the body on the other side that was stopping it going further. I squeezed through and checked. It was just another poor fucker in his 20s who wanted his mother. I stumbled into a chair, moved round it, and heard someone else moaning at my feet. Kneeling down, I got in there with the torch and turned the body over. It was Tom. Red brick dust over his face and head, red snot running from his nose. But alive. I'd thought this would be a cause to celebrate, but now I wasn't too sure. He didn't look good. He was whimpering away in a world of his own, reminding me of the glue-sniffing kid in Narva. I checked him over to make sure he had all his limbs. "You're okay, mate," I said. "You're all right. Come on." He wouldn't have a clue what I was saying or who was saying it, but it made me feel better. I brushed the crap from his face so at least he could open his eyes at some stage. Then I reached under his armpits and dragged him out onto the landing, stopping twice to snort muck from my nose. Still gripping him, I went down the stairs backwards. His feet bounced from step to step. He was out of it, still bound up in his own little world of pain and confusion, aware that he was being moved but not really conscious enough to help. We got clear of the brick dust and into the fresh air. Dumping him on the ground, I cleared my nose again and gasped clean air into my lungs. "Tom! Wake up, mate! Tom! Tom!" I grabbed a handful of snow and rubbed it over his face. Beginning to recover, he coughed and spluttered but still couldn't speak. The flames coming from the generator building were licking hungrily at the barn door and dancing on the snow, illuminating us quite clearly. Tom was wearing the same sweatshirt as when I last saw him, but he had no shoes or coat. "Wait here, mate. Don't move, all right?" As if. I headed back into the dust-filled MTV room. The cries upstairs were getting louder. I wanted to get away from here before they sorted themselves out and the police or DTTS arrived. I found the first body again, still smouldering. He hadn't been wearing a coat, but it was his footwear I was after. They weren't exactly walking boots, more like basketball trainers, but they do. Kicking and fumbling around, I also came across an AK and a coat amongst the shredded furniture. Tom was lying spread-eagled on his back, exactly as I'd left him. I shook the dust out of what turned out to be a parka and put it around him. The white trainers were about two sizes too big, but what the fuck? He only had to make it as far as the car. As I began to pull them onto his feet, he finally made a noise. He lifted a hand to wipe the shit from his face and saw me. "Tom? It's Nick." I shook his head. He would have been deafened by the explosion, and I couldn't tell whether his hearing had come back yet. "It's me. Nick. Get up, Tom. We have to get going."
"Nick? Shit. What the fuck are you doing here? What the fuck happened?"
I finished tying his laces and slapped his feet. "Get up now. Come on."
"What? What?"
I helped him up and into the parka. It was like dressing an exhausted child. "Tom?" He still couldn't hear. "Tom! Tom!"
"Huh?"
He was trying to get an arm into a sleeve. "I'll be back in a minute, okay?" I didn't wait for a nod. Leaving him to it, I went back to retrieve my gloves. I found them just feet away from the first man I'd shot, who was now clearly dead. Tom had sat down again in the snow. I got him upright, zipped up his parka, then helped him move slowly to the small gate leading to the derelict hangar. "We've got to get a move on, Tom. Come on, let's go. There's a car just round the corner." Turning left onto the road, I checked for vehicle lights. I lengthened my stride, keeping a tight grip on Tom, holding him as if we were a couple out for the night, arm in arm. Trying to keep upright on the ice as I urged him on, I looked behind me. The glow from the generator building was still visible, but the sky was no longer filled with flames. In the small amount of ambient light, I could see Tom's face. It was in a bad way. His hair was sticking up all over the place, still covered in dust and blood, and he looked like the victim of a cartoon explosion. "Tom?" I looked into his eyes for signs of acknowledgement, but got none. "We're going to the car. It's not far. Try to keep up with me, okay?" I wasn't too sure what his answer was. Something between maybe and what. His hearing had recovered a bit by the time we got to where I'd parked the car, but he still didn't know what day it was. I collapsed on my hands and knees, gulping in cold air. Fuck the teeth, my arse hurt even more now. But what hurt most of all was realizing that the car had gone. My head spun. Maybe I had the wrong place. No, there were tire marks. There, too, were some other tire marks, and besides my footprints, there was a mass of others. The new tire marks were very wide and deep, probably from a tractor. The fuckers. The pub quiz team must have had the car away, along with my two spare weapons. Shit. The car's been nicked. I wasn't too sure if I was informing Tom or trying to get my own head around it. Tom was confused.
"You said..."
"I know what I said, but the car's gone." I paused. "Don't worry, it's not a drama." It was. Chances were they hadn't even had to break into it, just hitch it up and slide the locked wheels across the ice. Mr. and Mrs. Fuckup had been well and truly at home from the moment I first stepped into the Intercontinental Hotel. For a second, I wished I hadn't let the tyres down on all three vehicles in the Jenny building. Then I remembered that by now they'd all be toast. The best thing I could hope for in this neck of the woods was another tractor. But if I lifted one, I'd be making people aware that we were on the ground. In any case, we didn't have time to search. There was only one option right now, and that was to walk it. I got up off the ground. "Tom? Change of plan." Well, there would be once I'd worked one out. But first, we had to get further away from the area and quickly. At least the stars were now fully out, and it was easier to see and be seen. Slowly coming to his senses, he stood there, arms crossed and hands tucked under his armpits, coughing up brick dust and waiting for my decision. "Follow me." I started to move down the road, putting distance between us and the target. Tom trailed slowly behind. We'd gone about 400 meters as I sorted out a plan, then stopped and checked for Polaris, the North Star. Tom was starting to spark up a bit more now that he was generating some warmth. He closed up to me as I gazed skyward.
"It was a fucking nightmare in there," he muttered. "But I know Liv will get you to come."
I cut in, hoping to shut him up. "That's right, Tom. Liv's your fairy godmother." I didn't tell him what she had planned for midnight. His head was down, and I could see steam coming off his thick, red-bricked hair, now that he had worked up a sweat. I pulled his hood up over his head to retain some of the body heat and checked the North Star again.
"Nick, what happened to, you know, fucking nightmare or what?"
"What?" I had a load of questions for him as well, but now wasn't the time or place.
"You know, the fence, the house. What was all that about?"
"It just wasn't important right now." "Tom." I kept looking skyward, even though I'd finished up there.
"What?"
I gave him the 1,000-yard stare. "Shut the fuck up."
"Oh."
I'd got the reply I wanted. I confirmed the plan in my head for the last time before I actioned it. We'd head north and cross country until we hit the railway line. If we turned left along it, we'd be facing west towards Tallinn. Then we would follow the tracks to a station and catch a train, maybe the first one out of Narva. I wasn't sure, but I thought it left there about 8-ish in the morning. So we'd need to be at a station about an hour after that. Only once we'd reached Tallinn would I start to worry about how to get us both out of the country. According to the Lion King, we had the best part of 14 hours in which to cover what I guessed would be about 20 km. Not a problem, so long as we got a move on. Tom was still facing me, trying to work out why I was gazing at the heavens. I got in there before he had a chance to ask. "We'll have to get back to Tallinn by train now."
"Where's that then, mate? Aren't we going to Helsinki?"
I looked down, but I couldn't see his face. He had moved the wire sewn into the rim of his hood, so the fur closed off his face, making him look like Liam Gallagher after a big night out. "We are," I said, "but we've got to go to Tallinn first." From behind the fur came a muffled,
"Why's that?"
"It's the easiest way. We've got to move up to the railway track, get a train to Tallinn, then catch a ferry to Helsinki." I didn't even know if he was aware what country he was in. I got right up close so he could see me smiling, trying to make it sound not too much of a big deal. His mind was obviously on other things as his voice came out of the darkness.
"Are they all dead? You know, that lot back there?"
"I think so. Most of them anyway."
"Shit. You killed them. Won't we get in trouble? You know, the law?"
I couldn't be asked to explain, so I just shrugged. It was the only way I could get you out of the shit. His shoulders began to heave, and I suddenly realized he was laughing.
"How did you know when to set a bomb off? I mean, I could have been killed if I hadn't been upstairs."
It was nervous laughter. I looked up, searching for the North Star again so he couldn't see my face. "You've no idea the trouble I went to, mate. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. We have to get a move on now."
"How far do you reckon?"
His Parker hood was looking skyward too, but he didn't have a clue what he was looking for. He started to shiver. "Not far, Tom. Just a couple of hours. If we play our cards right, we'll be in a nice, warm train carriage soon. Why tell him the truth now? I hadn't bothered to so far. You ready, then? He was coughing up the last of the brick dust like a TB patient.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I started down the road and he followed on behind. After just a couple of hundred metres, we hit a tree line, about 15 metres off the road on our left. I headed for it, leaving ridiculous amounts of tracks in snow which was up to my knees and sometimes waist high. It didn't bother me. Why worry about things you can't change? I waited for Tom to catch up. The pace wasn't going to be anything to write home about. You have to move at the speed of the slowest. That's just how it is if you want to keep together. I wondered about improvising snowshoes by tying tree branches to our feet, but quickly decided against. These things look good on paper, but in the dark, it's just a pain in the arse to prepare and wastes time. I looked up. Wispy clouds were starting to appear and scud across the stars. Tom caught up, and I allowed him a minute's rest before we moved on. I wanted to get out into the open fields before starting cross-country, following Polaris. That way, we'd give the compound a wide berth, as we had to head north, back towards it. At the end of the tree line, visibility was about 50 to 60 metres in the starlight. The landscape was white, fading to black. In the middle distance to my half-left, I could see the dim glow of the target area. I felt the cold bite into my face as I looked up at the sky once more. Tom shuffled up next to me, knees buried in snow, standing so close that his breath merged with mine, losing itself in the wind. His hood was off again as he tried to cool down. I put it back up and slapped him on the head. "Don't do that. You'll lose all the heat you've just generated." He pulled the fur around his face once more. I tried to find a reference point on the ground north of us, but it was too dark. The next best thing was to pick a star on the horizon below Polaris and go for that. It was easier than constantly checking skywards. I got one, not as bright as some, but good enough. "Ready?" The hood moved, and the material rustled as a head nodded about in there somewhere. We headed north. The only positive thing I could think of was that the pain in my arse had now disappeared. Either that, or it was even colder than I'd realized. Chapter 43. The ground beneath the snow was ploughed, so both of us kept slipping and falling on the angled, frozen furrows. The best way forward seemed to be to keep my feet low and push through the snow. I became the icebreaker, and Tom followed in my wake, anything to speed him up. Clouds drifted across the sky more frequently now, intermittently blotting out my guide on the horizon. Polaris, too, was in and out of cloud cover. Tom lagged about 10 metres behind, hands in pockets, head down. There was nothing to do but keep pushing north as the clouds moved faster and gained in mass. After about an hour, the wind began to pick up, attacking my face and tugging at my coat. It was time to put down the furry ear flaps. Each time we lost direction, all I could do was keep heading in what I thought was a straight line, only to find that we were way off course when the cloud cleared. I felt like a pilot flying without instruments. Our trail through the snow must have been one long zigzag. My major concern was that the wind and cloud would bring snow. If that happened, we'd lose our means of navigation. And without protection, catching the train would be the least of my worries. With a bad feeling that we were going to be in even deeper shit very soon, I stopped when I found a natural dip and used my back to push a groove in the snow to get us out of the wind. I scraped a channel in the lip to act as my north marker before Polaris disappeared again. Tom reached me as I dug myself in with my gloved hands. I expected him to follow my example, but when I turned he was having a piss, the steam and liquid disappearing almost immediately in the wind. He should have been retaining his warm body fluids at all costs, but I was too late. I went back to preparing our makeshift shelter. Stress hormones are released in cold weather, filling out the bladder more quickly. That's why we always seem to urinate more when it's cold. The problem is that you lose body heat, and a serious thirst develops. Unless hot fluids are taken on board, it's a vicious circle from there on in, with dehydration helping to bring down the body's core temperature. If your core temperature falls below 28.8 degrees C, you will die. Tom was done, and putting his hands back in his pockets, he turned and collapsed, arse first, into the dip. The wind hit the lip, sounding like one of the gods blowing across the neck of a bottle and blasting the snow onto our backs and shoulders. Tom's fur rim turned to me as I slid into the dip beside him. I knew what he was going to ask. "Not long now, mate," I preempted. "It's a bit further than I thought, but we'll have a rest here. When you start to get cold, tell me, and we'll get moving again, okay?" The hood moved, which I took to be a nod. He brought his knees up to his chest and lowered his head to meet them. I bit off my gloves and held them between my teeth while I fumbled to tie the ear flaps under my chin. Then I unzipped his parka a bit so he could ventilate, yet still retain his body heat. Finally, standing up into the wind, I undid my trousers and tucked everything back in, and pushed the bottoms of my heavy, wet jeans into my boots. It was a cold and uncomfortable process in wet, clingy clothes, but it was worth it. I would have lost heat doing it, but sorting my shit out always made me feel better. As I was about to lie down again in the dip, I saw Tom tucking his hand into his sleeve and lifting some snow to his mouth. I put out a hand. "That's off the menu, mate." I wasn't going to waste energy explaining why. Not only does it use up crucial body heat through melting it in your mouth, it also cools the body from the inside, chilling the vital organs. Nevertheless, water was going to be a problem. I put my gloves back on and scooped up a handful of snow, but only passed it over when I'd worked it into a compressed ball. "Suck on that. Don't eat it, okay?" I looked at the sky. The cloud cover was now more or less total. Tom soon lost interest in the ice ball, hunching once more into a fetal position, knees up by his chest, hands deep in his pockets and head down. His body was starting to shake, and I had to agree with him. I'd had better days out. Now that we'd cleared the danger area and were resting for a while, it seemed the right time to ask him a few questions. I hoped it would help take his mind off the shit we were in. I also needed some answers. "Why didn't you tell me you knew Valentin? I know you were trying to access Echelon at Menwith Hill for him." I couldn't see his reaction, but there was movement in the hood. "I'm sorry, mate," he mumbled. "She's got me by the bollocks. I'm sorry. I really wanted to. It's just that... you know." His hood drooped down as if his neck muscles had lost control. "You mean threats? Some kind of threat to you or your family?" His shoulders jerked up and down as he fought to contain the sobs. "Mum, Dad, and I've got a sister with kids. Know what I mean? I wanted to tell you, Nick. Honest I did, but... well... you know. Listen, it ain't Valentin doing this shit, mate. It's her. She's freelancing. He don't know a thing about it. She's just using his name, letting you think you're working for him." He didn't need to say any more. Things were suddenly making more sense to me than they had in a long time. That was why she'd been able to say yes straight away to the 3 million. That was why she'd insisted there was to be no contact with anyone apart from her. It even explained why she didn't want me to have a weapon. She probably thought that if I found out what was happening, I'd use it against her. "How did you get sucked back into all this?" I waited for him to try to compose himself.
Liv? Well, not her to begin with. But this bloke, Ignati, he came and saw me in London, the day before you did. Where'd I heard that name before? Then I realised he was the underwriter. It had been his name on the piece of paper in Narva. So maybe Liv wasn't the only one of Val's people to be going freelance. Now Tom had started babbling, it was important not to ask the sort of questions that might suddenly make him realise he was saying too much. I just said gently, "What happened then, mate?" He said Liv had a job for me, and that I'd be going to Finland. That someone would come and persuade me and all that stuff. I shat myself when I found out it was Echelon again. But I had no choice, mate. My sister and what have you. Nick, you got to help me. Please. She'll kill everyone if I don't sort this shit out. Please help me. Please. He wept into his hood. Tom. He didn't register. Maybe his sobs were too loud for him to hear me. Tom. She wanted you dead. She will think you're dead if I tell her. His hood came up. You were going to kill me? Oh, fuck, Nick. Don't. Please don't. I'm not going to kill you. He wasn't listening. I'm so sorry, Nick. She made me ask those questions. You know, in the train station. She wanted to know if you were going to stitch her up or what. I had to do it. She knows everybody's addresses and everything. The bloke showed me pictures of my sister's kids. Honest, Nick, I wanted to tell you what was happening, but... His hood dropped back down as a new spasm took hold of him. I felt like a priest in a confession box. Tom, listen. Really, I'm not going to kill you. It was me who got you out of there, remember? There was a small nod from within the hood. I'll make sure that you and your family are looked after, Tom. But we have to get back to the UK first. You'll have to talk with some people and tell them exactly what's been happening. At Menwith and here, okay? I sensed an opportunity for everything to work out, whichever way this went. I wasn't exactly sure how, but there had to be a way that Tom could get a new life, and I could get my money. And if the money didn't materialise, at least I could still work for the firm. I could come up with enough bullshit to make it sound as if I'd known all along what was happening, but couldn't tell anyone because of the security risk of someone printing off the information I'd told them in Russia. Liv need never know that Tom was alive, and I could still pick up my money and then go to Lynn. I knew it was flimsy as plans go, but it was a start, assuming she didn't stitch me up. What was more important was getting out of Estonia. After that, I'd sit down with Tom, get the full story, and sort my shit out. Why didn't she just tell me that it was you coming with me, rather than getting me to try and talk you into it? You were already coming, right? His babbling before hadn't exactly explained it clearly. Fuck knows. You'd have to ask her. That's why I shat myself when I saw you. I thought your lot had heard about it. She's weird, mate. Did she talk as if it was all coming from Valentin? Of course. Well, it ain't. She's talking about herself. It's all her own plans, mate. I'm telling you, if Valentin knew, he'd cut her in half. Know what I mean? Well, not quite in half. But I bet he'd have her watching a few squirming eels before he'd finish with her. For all that, there was a part of me that admired what she was doing. Maybe the man from St. Petersburg was her feed in Val's setup, leaking her information to set this whole thing up. What was in it for her? What was her goal in all this? Maybe Tom was right. It was everything that she had talked about. Question after question leaped into my head, but the snowflakes hitting my face made me remember that there were more pressing matters to attend to. We had no shelter, no heat, and now no navigation.
The cold was getting to me as the sweat on my back began to cool rapidly now that we had been stationary for a while. Tom shivered badly, where he sat curled up on the snow beside me. Both of us had inherited a layer of snow. We had to move, but in which direction? The marker would only be good for 100 meters or so. After that, and without Polaris, we'd get disoriented and spend the rest of the night walking round in circles. I looked at Tom and felt him shivering in almost uncontrollable bursts. His brain was probably telling him he must start moving, but his body was begging him to stay where he was and rest. I lifted the cuff of various layers of clothing and had a quick look at the Lion King. Just under 12 hours to go until we should RV with the train. Even if I knew which direction to take, trying to cover that distance in these conditions without navigation aids would be madness. Visibility had worsened. It was down to about 5 meters. In any other circumstances, we should have been digging in for the night and riding out the storm, but we didn't have the luxury of time. Quite apart from making it to a train, I didn't know what sort of follow-up the Malaskaya would go for. And I didn't want to find out. Trying to think of a positive, I finally dredged one up. At least the snow would cover our trail. Tom mumbled under his hood. "I'm really cold, Nick." "We'll get going in a minute, mate." I was still racking my brain for some sort of navigation aid. It had been years since I'd had to use or even remember any survival skills. Scrolling through the pages of crap in my head, I tried hard to call up what I'd learned all those years ago. I'd never been one for all that 101 uses for a shoelace stuff. I'd just got on with it, and only did the snow hole and snared rabbit routine when I had to. I put my arms around him. He wasn't too sure what was going on, and I felt his body stiffen. "It's a snow thing," I said. "We've got to keep warm." He leaned in towards me, shivering good style. "Nick, I'm really, really sorry, mate. If I told you the truth, we wouldn't be in this shit, know what I mean?" I nodded, feeling slightly uncomfortable. It wasn't all his fault. I'd have tried to drag his granny over that fence if it would have given me half a chance of pocketing 1.7 million. "I'll tell you the best thing I've found to get over all this cold stuff," I said, trying to sound as relaxed about it as possible. From under the hood came a muffled, "What's that then?" "Dream, mate. Just think to yourself that this will all be over soon. This time tomorrow you're going to be in a hot bath with a huge mug of coffee and a fat sticky bun. This time tomorrow you'll be laughing about all this shit." He kicked his heels into the snow. "That's if these poxy trainers stay on." "Don't moan," I said. "They're better than those fucking stupid daps of yours." He started to laugh, but it turned into a cough. I looked up and saw nothing but blankets of white tumbling down at us out of the blackness. If I'd had access to a genie at that moment, the one thing I'd have wished for was a compass. Jesus. A compass. A compass can be made from any ferrous metal. It should have been so simple, but it seemed to take me forever to work it out. Tom had a face full of the stuff in the rim of his parka hood. Could I use it? And if so, then what? It was like trying to remember the ingredients of a particularly complicated cake I'd been shown how to bake 20 years ago. I tried hard to visualize the process, closing my eyes and thinking back to all those times when I'd got so bored making shelters, traps and snares with bits of string and picture wire. Tom had other ideas. "Let's go, Nick. I'm cold. Come on. You said..." He was clinging to me like a baby monkey on its mother's back. It was good. I needed him to warm me just as much as he needed me for reassurance. "In a minute, mate. In a minute." Something had to be in the memory bank somewhere. You never forget anything. It can all be brought back to the surface if you press the right button. It happened. The trigger was remembering being given a silk escape map in the Gulf, with a needle pinned in it. "Tom, Are you still wearing those silk thermals? He shook his head. My heart sank.
Nah, just the top. I wish I did have the bottoms, I'm freezing. Can we go now? You said to tell you, Nick, and I'm telling you.
Hang on a minute, mate. I've just had a great idea. I unwrapped my arm from him. As I moved, I was forcibly reminded of the awful discomfort of my wet clothing. My jeans clung to my legs and my T-shirt was cold and clammy. I removed my glove, holding it in my mouth while I pulled out the Leatherman. Opening the pliers, I put the glove back on before the skin of my hand was exposed for too long.
Look at me for a sec, would you, mate?
The Parker hood came up, and the snow that had collected on it fell onto his shoulders. Feeling around the frozen ring of fur with my gloved hand, I located the wire. Then trapped it in the jaws of the pliers and squeezed until I felt it give. Teasing apart the material at the site of the cut, I exposed the metal, gripped one end of the cut with the pliers and pulled, grasping the exposed wire in my hand. I made another cut and put the 2-inch strip inside my glove for safekeeping. I thought Tom might have been interested, but he was concentrating 100% on feeling cold and miserable. Bending down some more, I peered into the darkness behind his hood.
I need some of that silk, Tom.
He shrugged.
I don't have to take it off, do I?
Just unzip your coat a bit more so I can get a hand in. I'll be as quick as I can. His hands slowly came out of his pockets and fumbled for the zip. In the end, I shoved both of my gloves between my teeth so I could help him. Then, having battled with numb fingers to open the blade of the Leatherman, I felt under his shirt. He sat there like a tailor's dummy as I pulled at his clothing. I didn't have enough feeling in my hands to be gentle about it, and he flinched as my freezing fingers gripped the silk and came into contact with his skin. My nose was streaming as I grabbed a handful of the best and started cutting, pulling so hard that I nearly lifted Tom off the ground. I wanted to make sure the material ripped, so there were loose threads dangling. The knife jerked as it made its final cut. Tom yelped as the tip of the blade flicked into his chest. He sat there with an exposed finger over his little cut, the snow settling on his hand. I said, "For fuck's sake, Tom, keep the heat in." He pulled his clothing together, shoving his hands back in his pockets and dropping his head.
"Sorry.
I tell you what," I zipped him up once more. "I'm going to be a couple of minutes doing this. Why don't you do some exercises to get some heat going?"
"I'm all right. How much longer do you reckon to the train, Nick?"
I dodged the question.
"Come on, move about. It'll warm you up."
He started to move as if he was snuggling under a duvet. But the only thing covering him was snow.
"No, Tom, you've got to get up and get your body moving. Come on. We haven't got that far to go, but we won't make it if you start seizing up."
I shook him.
"Tom, get up."
He hauled himself to his feet reluctantly as I brushed the snow from his shoulders. His fur rim was now a white ring of snow framing his face.
"Come on, with me."
Hands in pockets, we started to play aerobics with his back to the wind, squatting down and standing up again, elbows out, flapping like demented chickens. I kept my head down, protecting it from the wind, as I got him to keep in time with me.
"Good stuff, Tom. Now keep going, I won't be long."
I got back on my knees and into cover. It was gloves off time again, as I lay them in the snow. I crouched over to protect myself from the snowstorm. My hands were so numb that I had to pull threads from the silk with my teeth. Once I'd teased out a decent bit, about 5 inches long, I put it between my lips and fished out the needle-sized length of wire from my glove. Tying the loose end of the silk shakily around the middle of the metal, I finally managed